Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about the resignation of the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and his legacy or what he has wrought at the Department of Defense. We'll be speaking with Dr. Lawrence Korb, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information. Lawrence Korb served as Assistant Secretary of Defense from 1981 to 1985 in the Reagan administration. On November the 8th, he published with Brian Katulis Strategic Redeployment 2.0, a progressive study of Iraq described as a reasoned, pragmatic plan to strategically redeploy our military forces in Iraq and around the region to fight our terrorist enemies in the most effective and most lethal fashion possible. So we'll be talking to Dr. Korb both about Donald Rumsfeld and also his Strategic Redeployment 2.0. And then we'll speak with Mel Goodman, who is a senior fellow and director of National Security Program at the Center for International Policy. He's also a professor in international security studies and chairman of the International Relations Department at the National War College. And he was a division chief and senior analyst at the CIA's Office of Soviet Affairs from 1976 to 1986. He was a senior analyst at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from 74 to 76. And he was an intelligence advisor to the strategic arms limitation talks in Vienna and Washington. He is co-author of The Wars of Edward Shevardnadze. And, of course, Mel Goodman testified against the confirmation of Robert Gates as CIA director during the Bush 1 administration, and we'll be talking about Rumsfeld's successor at the Department of Defense, Robert Gates. And then in the last segment, we'll speak in the studio. We'll be joined by Max Blumenthal, who's a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute based in Washington, D.C. His work has appeared in the Nation Salon and the American Prospect and Washington Monthly, and his recent articles have covered the coming gay GOP purge, the internal machinations of the Reverend Moon-funded Washington Times, and the right-wing backstory to ABC's 9/11 five-hour, $30 million docudrama. This weekend, Max infiltrated the Liberty Film Festival, which is a group of right-wing Hollywood activists who want to stem the tide of godless communists here in Hollywood. They presented an award to ABC Television's vice president for the factually challenged 9/11 docudrama. I'm now speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center of Defense Information. Lawrence Korb served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration from 1981 to 1985. And he has published on November the 8th with Brian Katulis, Strategic Redeployment 2.0, a Progressive Strategy for Iraq. And let's begin, Lawrence Korb, with your post-mortem, if you will, on the tenure of Donald Rumsfeld at the Department of Defense, obviously a tempestuous one that's involved the United States getting into two wars, one of which we appear to have lost and the other one which we appear to be in the process of losing. Give us your assessment.
Right. Well, a Secretary of Defense has two responsibilities. One, he's the Deputy Commander-in-Chief, and of course he then is responsible to the President for the strategy and its implementation in both Afghanistan and Iraq, and he is also the chief executive of the world's largest organization, the Department of Defense, or as people call it, the Pentagon. In my view, he has been a failure in both areas. If you take a look at as the deputy commander in chief, while the initial phase of the war in Afghanistan went well, he right from the beginning wanted to go to Iraq, feeling that they had, to his words, more targets, and somehow another thought it, they were a bigger threat, even though they were not related to what happened on September 11th. He assured the country before the war, he not only said they had weapons of mass destruction, he said on the News Hour with Jim Lehrer that he knew where they were. So in effect, he misled the people, and then, of course, he failed to anticipate what the military calls phase four, not only anticipate but plan, which means, what do you do after you bring about regime change? In fact, he threatened to fire anybody who told him the plan for phase four. So consequently, there was no guidance even given to the troops, the 3rd Infantry Division that liberated Baghdad, and we did not have enough troops to get the country under control. And then an insurgency, which wasn't planned, was allowed to develop, and that, of course, metastasized into a civil war. He insisted that the Pentagon be in charge of the post-war planning, and Ambassador Bremer worked for him. He then went along with Ambassador Bremer's decision to disband the Iraqi military and the Iraqi government, which basically meant nobody was in charge. And then in the beginning of the insurgency, he refused to recognize it. He wouldn't even allow them to use the term, and he kept talking about dead-enders and other euphemisms to avoid facing the reality. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, handling the war, obviously, now the ultimate responsibility is the president's, but, I mean, he is the deputy commander-in-chief. He's the one who advised the president, and we know that he really, you know, made it very difficult for military leaders to go to the president and voice their own doubts about the strategy that he was pursuing.
Well, it does seem, though, Lawrence Kolb, that Donald Rumsfeld wasn't satisfied with just being the Secretary of Defense. He and his he's in effect the mentor in many ways of the Vice President Dick Cheney. He brought him into government, and they're pretty much joined at the hip. And it seems that Rumsfeld wasn't simply satisfied with being the Secretary of Defense. He wanted also control foreign policy. And
he did. You
served in the Reagan administration, where you were caught between the Caspar Weinberger George Shultz battles. But give me a sense of how this one worked out, because we all know that Colin Powell was the loser.
Well, there was a big difference. There's no doubt about the fact that Secretary Shultz and Secretary Weinberger had their differences, and there was a great amount of tension between the two men going back to the days at the Office of Management and Budget and at Bechtel, where Secretary Shultz was Secretary Weinberger's boss. But the difference was those of us at the sub-cabinet level in the departments got along fine. The difference here is that not only was Rumsfeld not getting along with Powell, but the people working for him weren't getting along. And whatever else you may say about Shultz and Weinberger, they did not undermine what we call the National Security Council decision-making process. What Rumsfeld would do is, you know, after a meeting, then he'd go back door to Secretary Cheney. Cheney would go to the president, and all of the things worked through the normal decision-making process were undermined. Neither Secretary Shultz or Secretary Weinberger would ever do that. They would have their differences. They would argue it out, but they never would try and not implement the policy or refuse to return phone calls from the National Security Advisor, which Rumsfeld did.
Well, am I to take Lawrence Kolb that? Because you were on CNN the other day debating Dov Zakheim, who was, mm-hmm. was trying to make a case for Rumsfeld, which, frankly, I failed to see what case he made. But the long and the short of it is that it seems to me that the explanation for the failure in Iraq might well come down to Rumsfeld's own arrogance and personality, in as much as the reason that we did it so poorly was that Rumsfeld was so tied to his idea of a lean and mean, nimble force that he just literally was trying to prove a point at the expense of the United States and our position in the world.
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that his idea of transformation, he wanted to show that it worked in the battlefield, and he thought it worked in Afghanistan, but what he forgot is the ground forces were supplied by the Northern Alliance. And so this idea that it was just a few Americans there, you know, that's how they won the war. No, you had the ground forces supplied by the Northern Alliance, which, of course, has led to continuing problems because those warlords or drug lords have really not disbanded, and they're controlling parts of the country. And again, when people recommended putting more forces in, General Shinseki said several hundred thousand. The RAND Corporation basically said 500,000. He thought, well, this is just an attempt by these bureaucrats to undermine my transformation rather than looking at it objectively. So, yes, there is something to that. I mean, Rumsfeld seemed to have the attitude that everybody who opposed them was either a bureaucrat or a liberal in hiding in the administration.
Well, but let's just go back to Afghanistan. It turns out that I've spoken to some of the CIA people involved in that, that what went on there was, in fact, a titanic battle behind the scenes. When 9/11 happened, after the first cabinet meeting up, the first crisis meeting up at Camp David, the first thing that that the assistant secretary and apparently the secretary, Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld, instead of talking about Afghanistan and going after al-Qaeda, they were started to talk about Iraq. Fortunately, they were able to focus on Afghanistan, and then it turned out that the Pentagon really didn't have a war plan.
Right.
And then it turned out that the only people that had any connections there were the CIA. So they sent the CIA people in with special forces, with the local people, with suitcases full of cash, and essentially laser designators to bring in the air power. And then, frankly, they wiped out al-Qaeda and the jihadis. And apparently this really upset Rumsfeld, almost in a childish way, that George Tenet was hanging out with the president and watching football games with him, and he got incredibly jealous, and he kept ginning up the Iraq war on the back burner. And then he started to he poached the special forces people from Afghanistan before the job was complete for their Iraq process. But so that record is pretty disgusting in terms of petty inside the beltway politics.
Well, it sure is, and the fact that you would let these petty jealousies involve fighting a war. I mean, it's one thing to argue about whether you ought to build this system or close this base or something like that. But when you're talking about people's lives and our security, yes, it is. It is not a very, very, good day for America when people like that do it. I was in Chicago a couple of weeks ago speaking to one of Rumsfeld's close friends, and I asked him, what in heck is going on? And he said the problem with him is everything in life is a battle, that he has to win every single thing, regardless of, the stakes or the outcome. So if he says one thing, you say another, rather than saying, gee, well, maybe, you have a point. No, he's got to win. And you're right. I mean, and the record that we see in the books by, Bob Woodward and people like Tom Ricks and James Risen all, show the point that you made. And certainly that is not very becoming.
Well, what about this new situation in the White House with Robert Gates coming in to replace him, who was pretty much the point man on the Iraq study group? There's a sense that Jim Baker is bringing in adult supervision from the father's team, in effect to rescue the son, perhaps from himself or at least from Cheney. And you notice, of course, in these meetings that just took place with the new Democratic leadership, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, apparently Cheney sat in the room like a potted plant, didn't open his mouth. So is there a new alignment going on there?
Well, I think so. I think the vice president's clout obviously is diminished because he's the one who pushed Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense to be a counterweight to Colin Powell, because Cheney did not support Powell's philosophy in terms of, dealing with the world. And of course, with Rumsfeld gone, his power obviously will diminish. The fact that, Bob Gates is coming in there, given, working with the father as well as being a member of the, the Iraq study group, that certainly is a signal that they're open to make some changes in the policy. And I think one of the reasons for Rumsfeld going is that Secretary Baker was concerned that if he proposed any changes, Rumsfeld would undermine him, because whatever else you may say about him, he's a very, very skilled bureaucrat and has been able to stop things. For example, they wanted to bring in General Petraeus to the White House to kind of take a look at the Iraq policy. Now, General Petraeus was the head of the 101st Airborne in the invasion. Then he was in charge of training the Iraqi troops and probably one of the brightest minds in the Army today, and Rumsfeld vetoed it. I mean, so that's the type, clout that he has, and I think that's why, among other reasons, they wanted him out now.
But do you think that the appointment of Robert Gates, given his background in the intelligence world as a director of Central Intelligence and a career in the CIA, Is that signaling a new strategy in terms of the war on terror? Because, you know, obviously from day one, it seems, at least in my opinion, we got it wrong. The Bush administration, in declaring war, they, in effect, elevated al-Qaeda on the world stage. And it could have, the whole thing could have been handled much more quietly, much more in terms of the shadows, the intelligence world. We've actually just opened a hornet's nest and made things worse for ourselves. In effect, it looks like the president's, Bush's legacy is going to be that he moved al-Qaeda 1,000 miles closer to Europe and within hundreds of miles of Israel, and he created a failed state in Iraq that is now, as the Marine Corps intelligence report on al-Anbar says, is now controlled by al-Qaeda.
Well, that's right. I mean, the hope is that Bob Gates, having risen up through the ranks of the CIA and worked for the first president, Bush, will take a more realistic approach rather than an idealistic approach to dealing with these problems. I mean, one of the things you recognize...
By the way, I wouldn't call it an idealistic approach, Lawrence Corbett. It was a political approach that Karl Rove came up with, this idea of the war on terror. It made president a majority... It gave him the majority in the House. It made him a wartime president. So there was a domestic political constituent component to this.
Well, there's no doubt about it, but if you look at, just from the foreign policy point of view, the idea was that you would go into Iraq and you would transform the Middle East and you would have this democracy spread all throughout that region that would undermine terrorism, would even settle the situation between Israel and Palestine, and that, this idea of American omnipotence and exceptionalism that, we would be greeted as liberators because, unlike the British, people would know, our motives were different, and that, there were no limits to our power. So, I mean, from a foreign policy point of view, that's where I'm coming from. Now, there's no doubt about the fact that they used this for domestic reasons, and anybody who raised, a peep against their policy was considered unpatriotic. And remember Senator Daschle raised a few questions, and the White House press secretary said, well, you have to be very careful, in time of war, you're giving aid and comfort to the, to the enemy. So there's no doubt about it that they did use that occasion for domestic, political purposes. And, for example, what they did to Senator Max Cleland in Georgia, triple amputee from Vietnam, and he was opposed to taking away the union rights for the employees in the new Department of Homeland Security, and they were running pictures of Osama bin Laden with him during the campaign.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Lawrence Korb, give us a brief sketch of your strategic redeployment 2.0.
Well, basically, our plan is, unless you set a date certain to get out, the Iraqis will never make the painful political compromises which are necessary to create an Iraqi state that people are willing to support and fight and die for. We picked the end of 2007 because that would, fulfill our moral responsibilities. We've been there almost 5 years. The other is it will allow us to focus on Afghanistan, which, as you pointed out early on, is getting worse. We would not leave the region so that if something untoward should happen, we'd be able to deal with the situation. We'd keep a Marine Expeditionary Force and a Navy Carrier Battle Group in the Persian Gulf and keep soldiers in Kuwait, where we've been since 1991. And the other is, by doing that, it would enhance our opinion in the Arab world, because a lot of people don't think we came for the right reasons. They think we came for the oil or to despoil their civilization. And then Iraqis would stop supporting a lot of these insurgents because they were only supporting them because they think that's a way to get us to get us out of there. And we've urged it for over a year now that what you ought to have is a diplomatic track, which I think the Secretary Baker is going to talk about. Engage the countries in the region, which, when they know that you're leaving, I think will be more receptive to that. But basically, that's our plan. Now, people will criticize, and say, well, you can't guarantee that it's going to come out right. And, our point has been, look, given the mistakes that have been made, the reasons you went in, the way you've handled it, you can't come up with anything that, guarantees success. But I think this will minimize the damage to our policy and gives us the best chance of accomplishing something. Let me give you a startling statistic. Since the Iraqis had their elections in December, We're now 10 months away. They have not yet modified the Constitution or made the compromises or disbanded the militias. In that time, we have lost, in terms of killed and wounded soldiers and Marines, a battalion a month. So we've lost 10 battalions worth of brave men and women while these people are dithering.
And just in closing, are you did you get interviewed or will you get interviewed by the Iraq Study Group?
Not yet. I don't know if our proposals are too radical, but I was just thinking of that this morning when I was reading the paper about the people of guns. So hopefully, and again, it is a point of view, and I think it's gaining acceptance. In fact, a lot of military people, so we didn't support in the beginning, but we realize now unless we do that, these guys are never going to do what they need to do.
And the president, of course, is meeting tomorrow with Baker and Hamilton and the Iraq Study Group.
Right.
I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, we'd like to be with you.
Dr. Lawrence Korb, who again is the Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress and a Senior Advisor to the Center of Defense Information. He served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. And on November 8th, he published with Brian Katulis, Strategic Redeployment 2.0, A Progressive Strategy for Iraq. I'm now speaking with Mel Goodman, who is a Senior Fellow and Director of National Security Program at the Center for International Policy. He's also a Professor of International Security Studies and Chairman of the International Relations Department at the National War College. He was a division chief and senior analyst at the CIA's Office of Soviet Affairs from 1976 to 1986. He was also the senior analyst at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research from 1974 to 1976 and an intelligence advisor to the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks in Vienna and Washington. He is co-author of The Wars of Edward Shevardnadze, and he also testified back in the Bush 1 era against the confirmation of Robert Gates to become the director of Central Intelligence. And just touching, before we get to the subject of Robert Gates, Mel Goodman, I'd just like to touch on the Iraq Study Group because the president's meeting with them tomorrow. Do you believe that what is the principal purpose of this Iraq Study Group? And many argue that it is essentially a political document meant to rescue the White House from this quagmire in Iraq and give them political cover and a way out. So is its domestic political purpose playing at odds with its ability to actually come up with a real solution?
Hi, and good to be with you again. I guess I share your view that the Iraq Study Group, particularly under Baker and Hamilton, who are very political animals and not policy animals in a sense, are taking part in an exercise in damage limitation for the Bush administration. I don't think Hamilton has ever lived up to this glorious reputation he has. He wasn't a tough investigator during the Watergate period in the 1980s, and he certainly wasn't a tough investigator during the 9/11 commission, which was a sad disappointment to many of us who read that report. And I don't expect a very rigorous look from Hamilton now. Baker, of course, is there to represent Bush the elder and to protect the legacy of the Bush family. So this is damage limitation for George Bush now. Tuesday's elections results were far more devastating than I think the pundits have really suggested. If there hadn't been so much gerrymandering, there would have been loss of more than 50 seats instead of the around 30 that we've seen, let alone the Senate also going back to the Democrats that a lot of people did not expect. So this was shocking, and they had to do something bold. And I think for the short term, they did. Just getting Rumsfeld out of the way, I think this entire town, not just the Pentagon, this entire city is breathing a sigh of relief. So people are willing to overlook Bob Gates and all of the baggage that Bob Gates brings to this position. Let me say one other thing about the Iraq Survey Group that I find stunning. There's no Middle Eastern expert on that group. You have the same thing you had for the 9/11 Commission. They appoint five Democrats and five Republicans, and they say, well, this is bipartisan. That's not what bipartisan means. Bipartisan means that the two parties will come together and work together. 9/11 Commission, they had such a composition, and one group basically vetoed and blocked the more pointed discussions and recommendations of the other group. And I expect the same thing to happen with this group. But when you look at the 10, most of them are domestic specialists, former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Ed Meese. What in the world is Ed Meese doing a group of this type? I mean, I just think it's kind of transparent that this is politics. This is not policy.
And is there a possibility, some have argued, that the president will, since the father perhaps is rescuing his son from himself, as it were, do you think he will reject adult supervision? Because in many ways it seems that the president has a very frail psyche and that any concession to reality, the whole house comes down.
Well, there's been no adult supervision for the cabal, the group that Larry Wilkerson properly referred to as the cabal, Bush,
Larry Wilkerson
Cheney,
being Cheney's, being Colin Powell's
chief,
deputy, right.
Aide. Of course, now Rumsfeld is gone, and I think Cheney has been quarantined for the most part. Bush is out there all alone, which in some ways is even more terrifying than having Bush around without anyone around him. So it's hard to say where he's getting his guidance from and where he's getting his ideas from in a particularly difficult situation such as this one.
But don't you think, Mel Goodman, that given that Rumsfeld and Cheney are joined at the hip, and in effect Rumsfeld brought Cheney into politics, arguably his mentor, it was noticeable that Cheney didn't say a word in the meetings with the two, the House and Senate new leadership. He was very much a potted plant. So
well,
is he
Cheney,
on the way out, in other words?
Cheney, to me, well, he won't leave, but I think he's a dead man walking. What he's going to do now is sulk in his tent for the next 2 years. He really can't come out. He's got the lowest ratings of any politician. I think it's in single digits of any politician, not only in this administration, but any other administration I could think of. This is the real villain behind this whole piece, this whole strategy of the Iraq War. This is the villain who pushed the bogus intelligence. This is the villain who put Powell up at the UN with the phony CIA speech with the 24 assertions. This is the villain on torture, having his lawyer, David Addington, and then people like John Yoo and Jay Bobby write the memos that allowed the torture. This is the guy who outed Valerie Plame. He was the one who was behind that. He should have been an unindicted co-conspirator in the trial against Libby, and it should have been the trial against Libby and Rove. So Cheney really is the evil genius at work here, but I do think he has been neutralized. And the fact that we've learned that Cheney talks to Henry Kissinger more than anyone else outside the administration should be terrifying to anyone who's paying any attention at all and remembers anything about why it took 7 years to get out of Vietnam. You know, I just heard Larry Corbett, the interview, talk about how many Americans have died in the last 10 months. You know, how many Americans died in Vietnam after the Tet Offensive when it took us 70 years as we dragged our heels to get out of Vietnam. So these are very frightening times.
And Mel Goodman, when you called Cheney an evil genius, I don't get the genius part. I mean, he's got us into one war that we've lost, another war that we're in the process of losing.
Ironic. I was a lame. It was like John Kerry, you know, a lame reference, lamely told.
Okay.
And I apologize. It's like people refer to Karl Rove as Bush's brain. Yeah. Well, you know what that means.
Let's then talk now, if we can, about Robert Gates, who you know and who you testified against in first President Bush's administration for his confirmation as the Director of Central Intelligence. And he turned down the DNI job that Negroponte got. So,
well, that just showed good political sense. That is a terrible job. It's almost a non-job. And all Negroponte is a briefer to the president. So I think Gates was just using good judgment. Frankly, on this one, I don't think he had a choice. He's a creature of the Bush administration. George Bush gave him his directorship of the CIA. He's president of the Bush Academy, which some people call Texas A&M. So, frankly, I think there were no other candidates. As far as I know, no one mentioned another name. There were some reports that if they couldn't get Gates to do this, Rumsfeld was going to stay on. So I don't think Gates had any choice. He had to come to Washington for this.
Well, it's interesting, though, that this was in the works for a long time, and people like Newt Gingrich are furious with the White House for not dumping Rumsfeld before the election. They think that they could have held on.
Well, I think that George Bush has great difficulty doing this. On one hand, Rumsfeld was sort of Bush's bulletproof Kevlar vest on the Iraq War, because to many people it was Rumsfeld's war, and he was the lightning rod for this war. Now he's lost that lightning rod, because Gates is going to be able to say, when he gets stiff questioning, if he gets any stiff questioning from the Congress, that, gee, that I wasn't there for that decision. That was not my watch. So it's now Bush's war. There's no doubt about that.
Well, in terms of the role of intelligence, though, the idea is that the intelligence service are supposed to give the national leaders the unvarnished truth, that that they're supposed to speak truth to power and not politicize the information that the president's getting, which has to be connected to reality, because we're living in the real world and a very dangerous world. So we've had a very dysfunctional intelligence process for some time, given that back in the confirmation of Gates, the real issue was, are you going to politicize intelligence? We've had a politician in as the DCI, Porter Goss. So where do we stand in terms of the community itself's ability to act professionally?
There's a delicious irony at work here, because if you look at how we got into this war with bogus intelligence, fabricated intelligence, disinformation, misinformation, sources who were tortured, single sources who were presented as multiple sources, this is the biggest intelligence scandal in the history of the United States. So who does Bush turn to watch over the Pentagon right now, to be the steward of our military policy? Well, one of the great exponents of politicized intelligence, Bob Gates of the 1980s, who politicized intelligence on the Soviet Union, on Central America, on the Middle East, on arms control, on Southwest Asia. You know, just name the region, and I can give you examples of politicized intelligence by Gates and Casey, including one memo done out of whole cloth, the so-called papal plot assassination memo from 1985. So it's kind of ironic that an administration that's in trouble because of lies and specious intelligence turns to a master at lies and specious intelligence who likes to say in confirmation hearings, yes, I want intelligence with the bark on. This is a guy who removed more bark from memos that I wrote and assessments that I wrote in the 1980s than anyone else in my 24 years at the CIA. So this dog won't hunt. Bob Gates is a windsock. You know, people, I've read op-eds by people who should know better, Jim Mann and others. You know, is he a conservative realist? Is he a neocon? Is he just a conservative? Forget all the labels. This is a guy who's been a chameleon, who's always served his master. That's why Brzezinski and the Carter administration can say all these wonderful things about Bob Gates, and General Scowcroft, who's far more conservative than people understand, can say wonderful things about Bob Gates. He will serve the master. So really, if Bush is going to change policy, Gates will do his darndest to get that put into play at the Pentagon, something that Rumsfeld was fighting off, and Condi Rice, who did a miserable job as National Security Advisor, that's why she was promoted to Secretary of State, that's what she couldn't do. She couldn't see what the various agencies were doing, what kind of implementation was being done with policy. Bob will make sure the policy is implemented at the Pentagon, and if we are cutting back in Iraq, and frankly I don't expect that, it's going to be a very angry military that's going to be tarred with the kind of loss they took in Vietnam, and they've spent 30, 40 years restructuring their reputation, and they're going to be quite hostile. But I don't think the generals should be making the decisions about this war. This isn't a time for military decisions. They've bollocked the situation enough. This is a time for a political decision and a policy decision, and something that this administration has never shown any sign of whatsoever, strategic thinking. They haven't shown it on North Korea, on Iran, or Iraq, or frankly the Middle East, Israel. You know, just go right down the line. Show me one example of strategic policy, and I'll be stunned.
Well, that's in fact what General Hayden said in his confirmation, that there's a tremendous deficit in strategic thinking, and he was trying to figure out how to get a cadre together. But if you have a president who doesn't listen to the facts or not interested in reality, you have a real problem.
Well, he's God's messenger. That's what I heard him say once. And certainly the war was a faith-based initiative, just like National Missile Defense was a faith-based
initiative. It is a faith-based. I mean,
they don't work. I know. These just do not work.
But they've been deployed. Let me ask you that, Mel Goodman. You brought up the neocons. Where do they stand now? If you go back to your work at the CIA and with Bob Gates, the politicization, I mean, the neocons were running rabid with this idea of the papal assassination, of the Soviet Union being behind all the terrorism that was happening in Europe. And, of course, it turned out that you knew better, because it was the CIA's gray side of the house that was putting out this stuff. And it was being fed back as reality.
Classic,
so the neocons have basically been this group that believe that the CIA and the State Department are a flaccid bunch of unpatriotic wusses, and that we need a bunch of real men in there. And look what they've done. You give them some rope, and they'll hang the country.
They'll hang all of us. No, right. They've had their way for 6 years, and they have been routed, at least for now. In fact, it's interesting. Wolf is gone. Douglas Feith is gone. Rumsfeld wasn't a neocon, but he was a rabbi for all the other neocons, so what difference did it make? Libby is gone. Cheney is isolated, and he only has David Addington over there, plus his spies on the National Security Council. So I think the neocons have been routed. But you got to remember, they go back 30 years. All of this started in the 1970s in that short presidency of Gerald Ford, when Cheney was the chief aide to the president, and Donald Rumsfeld was the Secretary of Defense, and they tried to distort the intelligence at the CIA with the Team B. Remember Richard Pipes' group. And if you look at the Richard Pipes' group, they had a lot of the neocons, like Wolfowitz, like General Danny Graham, who came back later throughout the years, and some of them even returned during the Iraq War to fight what is essentially the most profligate decision that any American president has ever made. So I think for a short period of time, the neocons have been routed. I think we'll see more when John Bolton's recess appointment winds up, and I think Bush is going to have to look somewhere else for a U.N. ambassador. And this will be a very first test of this thesis that I'm attached myself to anyway, that Bush is practicing damage limitation. He can't go back. He's not going to push for Bolton rigorously. But he'll have to go into another direction to get maybe an internationalist at the U.N. and not someone who thinks you ought to lop the top 10 floors off the U.N. and you'll get a more effective international agency. So this is an interesting juncture.
It'd be interesting to see, though, whether Gates gets rid of Stephen Cambone, because...
I expect Steve Cambone to go. He is a neocon. He is probably... I taught at the National War College for 16 years, and given the contempt they have for this entire crowd, they have special contempt for Steve Cambone. They think he is the most malicious person in Rumsfeld's army over there. And the interesting thing will be, who will Gates bring in? Will they be old Carlisle allies from the CIA?
He said the Carlisle group almost.
Yeah, the Carlisle group. investment bankers. What are we going to see over there? The important thing that no one's mentioned is Rumsfeld was trying to do a little bit of good at the Pentagon and taking on the military in terms of defense acquisition and transformation and defense reorganization. Gates doesn't know anything about any of these issues. And the most important work of the Pentagon, aside from the war, but that really shouldn't be their decision anyway at this point, it's weapons acquisition and weapons procurement. You're talking about a $450 billion budget that's still climbing. Who in the world is Gates going to bring in to ride over that? And if you think Rumsfeld was a micromanager, those people over there have seen nothing.
Right,
the Pentagon, the ultimate micromanager.
Right, the Pentagon just asked for a $160 billion supplemental.
Exactly.
So, where's this money coming from? And I imagine the F-22 and all these big boondoggles may well be in the crosshairs just because of reality. But just in closing, Mel Goodman, it seems though that the president does actually have if this is adult supervision, and if the father can save the son's legacy and save the son from himself. And eventually Cheney will either become irrelevant or perhaps they could arrange for a heart attack, because, if they could put somebody in there to replace him, they could groom somebody for 08, because, and that obviously it looks like McCain. So what's your thought on...
You're talking about a man who's calling for sending more troops over to Iraq.
I understand.
I don't think Cheney's going anywhere. I don't think Bush is worried about his successor. I don't think he's worried about, will the Republicans hold the White House? I think it goes back to the article that General Scowcroft wrote in the New Yorker magazine about a year and a half ago. This is the Bush legacy. This is George Bush taking down the entire Bush family legacy in terms of politics and frankly, exposing the Bushes, both father and son, as total political cynics who really stood for nothing in terms of American politics other than power. And, of course, Cheney and Rumsfeld were experts in accumulating political power, which they did to the point, as you say, enough rope, and now they've hung all of us.
Yeah, but the difference is that
way.
But the difference, Mel Goodman, is that Bush won maintain the status quo. Bush, too, has wrecked the China. This has been the wrecking crew.
Oh, exactly. That's what they're trying to repair now. Everything we're seeing now, to me, is part of damage limitation. What impact it will have on Iraq, only time will tell. I wouldn't expect too much. Mm-hmm. The sad thing about Iraq, and the amazing thing about Iraq, is how the Pentagon and the White House managed to let this situation deteriorate as much as it has, to the point now where, frankly, I don't think anything can be done about it. We're now talking about a full-scale civil war, and it's taken the White House over a year to even acknowledge that we're even seeing any activity that could be associated with a civil war.
We're talking
violence and sectarian violence.
We keep talking as though we have options, and I don't believe we have any.
No, I don't think we do.
I thank you for joining us, Mel Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Mel Goodman. He's a senior fellow and director of the National Security Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. He's also a professor of international security studies and the chairman of International Relations Department at the National War College. I'm now joined in the studio by Max Blumenthal, who's a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute based in Washington, D.C. His work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, American Prospect, and The Washington Monthly. He's a research fellow for Media Matters for America. His blog is at maxblumenthal.blogspot.com. His current articles have covered the coming gay GOP purge, the internal machinations of the Reverend Moon Fund and Washington Times, and the right-wing backstory to the ABC's 9/11 five-hour, $30 million docudrama. And this weekend, Max somehow got into the Liberty Film Festival, which is a Hollywood right-wing group of activists who are trying to force their way into the movie business. They've got political passion, but very little talent, it seems. And at this meeting that you infiltrated, the award was presented to an ABC television vice president for the factually challenged 9/11 docudrama. And Max, the last time we spoke, since you broke the story about who these people are that were behind this bogus, non-historical political hit on the Clinton administration, posing as the official record for what happened in 9/11, the last thing was I gave you a marching orders, find out where did the money come from and who was behind it. And now it looks like we know at least who their point person was inside the ABC, because ABC got hosed, didn't they? Their airtime was hijacked by a bunch of right-wing radicals.
Well, absolutely. What I had reported was that a group of Republican operatives sort of working within Hollywood had essentially hijacked ABC, and they'd created this so-called docudrama under a shroud of secrecy, which essentially was a five-hour anti-Clinton political commercial. The screenwriter is an outspoken conservative named Cyrus Norasta, and the Liberty Film Festival people, who are paid operatives of David Horowitz, were involved in promoting the film, and in the opening ceremonies they acknowledged as much. Suddenly, the Award of Freedom was presented to Judith Tookish, I think that's her name, who is the vice president of special projects for ABC. And her role was shepherding this movie from the production phase into completion without handling the pushback against the Democratic senators who had protested the fact that there were fabricated scenes depicting, for instance, Sandy Berger. Sandy Berger vetoing a raid that in which bin Laden was supposedly surrounded. Bin Laden was never surrounded. There are several fabricated scenes in it.
Yeah, he was in Kandahar, which is the middle of Pashtun territory, and they had the Northern Alliance people on the hill overlooking the camp with binoculars, was a completely historical nonsense.
So essentially, I reported there was a network within a network at ABC, but I didn't realize the extent to which ABC was involved in marketing this to conservative bloggers, conservative radio hosts, refusing to give advanced DVDs to the Clinton Foundation and to people around Sandy Berger because they understood that this was conservative propaganda. And
well,
this
it only woman, came out, wasn't it, because they had to show it to the 9/11 Commission, and one of the lawyer on that, the Democratic lawyer.
Was it Hamilton?
The other guy.
Benveniste.
Benveniste.
Benveniste confronted the makers of this movie outside a screening. He said it was a complete fabrication, it was a 5-hour political commercial. I just didn't realize how brazen ABC was going to be in sending this woman there to accept the Award of Freedom from an organization that's avowedly pushing a conservative, ulterior, sectarian agenda in Hollywood. And so I confronted her in the lobby about this. I said, do you think it's appropriate for you to be here as a representative of ABC? And she actually tried to push my voice recorder away with her hand. She was completely stone-faced. She looked as if I had caught her doing something naughty. Mm-hmm. And she attempted to hustle away. I followed her into the hallway, repeating my question. You know, she was, other people tried to step in between us. I mean, I was just, and I said, I'm just being a reporter. I'm just trying to, you know, hold you accountable. And she said, you have to talk to our media relations department. Well, I'd already tried to do that. They refused to talk to me, you know, before the film had come out. So ABC's not being accountable. Then,
now, do we know what the money trail is? Because they didn't have any commercials. Either they took a financial bath on this thing, or somebody funded it, or somebody bought the airtime.
Well, assuming they let me in, today, I'm going to be asking that question.
You're going back into the Liberty Film Festival today?
Unfortunately, I, committed myself to doing that. You know, it's not very good for my mental health.
Right.
I mean, especially having to watch these films. I mean, they're just absolute garbage. Mm. Absolute garbage. And I'll get into...
So was the 9/11 film. It was the worst piece of writing I've ever seen.
Well, I was nearly physically attacked by the screenwriter of that film. As I was, in this intimate moment going to the bathroom, I hear a voice over my shoulder. Are you Max? I want to talk to you, man. And as soon as I get out of the bathroom, Cyrus Norasta is screaming in my face that he's the modern Dalton Trumbo and he's been blacklisted because of me and he can't get any work and all the liberal...
I thought Oliver Stone had hired him.
Yeah, that's what they had announced, The official version in this festival was that he's talented and he's getting all kinds of work. But according to him, he's not. He's blacklisted. And this is sort of a conservative conspiracy theory that there's a Hollywood blacklist against anyone with professed conservative views. And so my response is what I tell, all conservatives in Hollywood who say there's a blacklist. I say, it's not my fault that you don't have any talent. And he didn't like that. The security guards thought it was funny, though. He was presented with an award of freedom, too.
So what is
it's sort of like the Medal of Freedom Bush gives out to all the
losers.
This
group, though, they're trying to use the political clout of the Republican majority to force their way into Hollywood and enhance their careers. In the absence of talent, they've got political clout. So now, of course, we have a different Congress. So maybe that may make some change. I mean, what do you think in terms of where they stand in terms of the community? Because hate people like they're obsessed with Barbara Streisand, they're obsessed with George Clooney and all these people. But the public like these people. They vote with their dollars when they go to the movies.
It's an interesting discussion to have. How does the conservative movement see itself? And I think this is the movement. We can't really talk about it necessarily as the Republican Party. But there was a short film they showed at the opening of the festival of a conservative punk band called the Repunklicans. Mm-hmm. A caption was flashed on the screen: "Conservative is the new counterculture." And I think conservatives like to see themselves as outsiders, and especially these Hollywood conservatives, they like to see themselves as opposition. And the only way they gain strength is by mobilizing resentment.
Right.
So I talked to the director of Gods and Generals and Gettysburg, these sort of neo-Confederate movies. I think his name is Robert Maxwell, and he told me, "Max, never forget, we're victims. We're victims of the elitists, and you're a victim." And I said, I thought I was a Hollywood liberal elite, but this is, so that's the position they want to be in. They're all, in a way, in a strange subconscious way, I think they're savoring the losses they suffered. And
because it increases the sense of martyrdom.
Exactly.
But the thing that's so transparent, though, is that these people have so much money behind them. I mean, Horowitz is funded by William, what's his name, Scaife, the billionaire, and all these right-wing, Olin, and all these incredibly right-wing foundations that have zillions of dollars, and they just throw money at him. There's no equivalent on the left. Have to spend all your waking hours, sucking up to some liberal foundation, if you seriously want to try and raise money on the left.
Yeah.
It's the balkanization of the left is unbelievable. Even the environmental groups don't talk to each other. It's a myth that there's any kind of left-wing conspiracy. And in the money world, the left-wing foundations don't hold a candle to the right-wing foundations.
Absolutely, and the right-wing foundations are involved in funding of the movies that were being shown. There's one movie in particular, actually several movies that have been produced by David Bossie, who's the head of a group called Citizens United, which is funded by SCAFE, Olin, Coors, all these, you know, sugar daddies, and they're pumping money into these documentaries, which are essentially 90-minute political commercials. The documentary I saw was called Border War, and it was the political commercial. This was an extension of, I would say, it was a Willie Horton ad, except it was applied to brown-skinned people, to immigrants. It was a very sophisticated anti-immigrant propaganda movie, and just to give some context on like who these people are, David Bossie is the former chief investigator for the Whitewater. The Whitewater investigation, and he was fired, totally humiliated because he had doctored tapes of Hillary Clinton's voice, you know, attempting to make it look like she had overbilled her law firm.
Right.
The first George Bush said we should, I'm paraphrasing, we should resist Bossie's sleaze tactics. But apparently, according to Bossie, you know, the Republican National Committee is totally behind what he's doing. You know, he's best friends with Ed Gillespie.
Right.
And these movies, this anti-immigrant movie is going to, you know, it's sort of beating the drum for what's going to be the big Republican issue in 2008.
But the thing that's so disgusting about the Horowitz people and all of these characters and Fox News is that these people are Soviets, you know. Fox is run like a Soviet operation. It is the Ministry of Propaganda, the Ministry of Information for the government. In a free society, the idea that you would willingly and volunteer yourself to become the propaganda organs of a government is so Soviet. It's so scary. And the same thing, the Soviet tactics that Horowitz has employed on campuses, where you actually pay people to inform on professors who you think are too lefty and too pinkish. That is classic Soviet, you know, Cuban. I mean, the people that watch the people in the buildings. Every time you'd go to the Soviet Union, there'd be some little babushka sitting on a floor, every floor of a hotel, to report who goes where. I mean, it's, you know, and they used to, you know, report on each other, on even their own parents. So again, I find these people actually to be anti-democratic and Soviet.
Well, they say they want an open debate, but when I get up and ask a question in the film festival, you know, asking questions about, why wasn't it presented that, for instance, some of the subjects of David Bossie's film are members of the Council of Conservative Citizens, America's largest white supremacist organization. I'm surrounded by people who are trying to force me out of the festival. But I think, part of the political agenda of this movement in Hollywood is to demonize the mainstream media, and which deserves to be demonized. But what they're trying to do is actually eliminate it and replace it. What they're claiming, you know, and I think they're a little bit behind the times, is that movies like Syriana and a lot of the films that are coming out of Hollywood are actually undercutting the war effort. So they sort of stabbed Americans and the troops in the back,
right.
And it's coming from Hollywood. And I
right.
think,
well, we need more of Chuck Norris. You know, that's the
yeah, more Sylvester Stallone. And
so just we have a couple of minutes left. I want to touch on the other work you've been doing. You've been doing amazingly good work on again. You know, you hang out with these right wing, which has got to be excruciating.
Oh, thank you.
But you also hang out with the Christian fundamentalists, you go to these meetings, you know. So what?
Yeah.
So finally, we've got Ted Haggart,
yeah,
the head of the National Council of Evangelicals, cavorting with a male prostitute who provides him with massages and methamphetamine. So,
well, I'm actually starting work on a book about James Dobson, and I listen to his show every day for Media Matters. So I sort of have a window into thinking, you know, at least the thinking they reveal of this movement. And, you know, I listened to a really interesting show by James Dobson, who's probably the most powerful figure on the Christian right. He's a close friend of Ted Haggart, and he was originally supposed to handle Ted Haggart's spiritual restoration, which means turning him from a gay into an ex-gay. And Dobson was sitting there with, his closest allies, and instead of saying, this is horrible, what they were saying was, actually, it's Ted Haggard today, but we know from our pastor outreach network that there are 100 Ted Haggards out there and that we're dealing with dozens of these cases. And if you are suffering from sexual temptation, call 1-800-FOCUS on the Family and we will help you. So this is a movement of it's a Ted Haggard movement.
Right, right. Every evangelical setback becomes a financial opportunity. I thank you very much for joining us in the studio, Max Blumenthal, again, Puffin Foundation, Writing Fellow of the Nation Institute. Your work appears on The Nation Salon, American Prospect, and Washington Monthly. And I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer,